recording to show this I'm going to have to use. I brought in a copy of a Quran because we're going to speak about the structure of the Quran, how it's put together, and some of the traditions as far as its composition. It's very beautiful calligraphy, and I'll pass it around so you can look at it as I'm talking, and then at the end of the lecture, I'll take it back. We're going to start with the name itself. Usually, it's spelled in many, many English language books, history books. It's spelled K-O-R-A-N or K-U-R-A-N. But since the Q represents the Kof, you're better off spelling it with Q-U-R-A-N. And it would come from the short is qara'a. Qara'a meaning to invoke, to call. And Quran is semantically, and etymologically related to the term in Hebrew mikra, a book that's read out. It's read out. It's called out. And the reading actually is really a secondary meaning. The first is to be called out. It's read aloud. Qara'a. You want to know how this book is structured? Is it similar in any way to the Hadith, to our Torah, and to our Mikra, which starts, of course, with Bereshit and ends with Divrei HaYamim? Just to show you the structure of the Quran, Quran has 114 surah. The word surah would be the equivalent of what we call Turaqim. 114 chapters. And except for the first chapter, which we'll speak about in a moment, they are organized in reverse order of length. By reverse order of length, we mean it will start with the longest, which is Suratul Al-Baqarah, the chapter of the cow, which has, I believe, 280 approximately verses. And it will go down and down and down until the final chapters have four or five verses. The term surah, as I said, meant chapter. And the term for verse is ayah. Ayah will be the same as ot, semantically the same as ot in Hebrew. Any question?
You said what?
Ot. Semantically the same. Yes, but ayah is a verse, but it's related to it in terms of etymology. The etymology is the same. But it goes in a different, slightly different direction. Rather than a letter, it means a verse. The chapters are arranged in two different categories. We have the earlier chapters, we have the later chapters. The earlier chapters are those chapters that were revealed in Makkah. And the earlier chapters begin in the year 610 CE. First revelation to Muhammad from the angel Jibreel in the year 610 CE. And go down to the year 622 CE. And from the period 622 CE, we have the second category of chapters. And those chapters were revealed in Medina. And the chapters will continue until the death of the Prophet Muhammad. This is 632 CE. And his birth, 570 CE, would make him approximately 62 years of age when he died. So the first revelation comes to him when he is approximately 40 years of age. And lasts from 610 to 620, 632 CE. So just to repeat again, the early revelations were in Makkah or Mecca, and the later revelations in Medina. Chapters themselves are usually centered around a common theme. In other words, except for one chapter, there's only one chapter in the Quran which is an actual story, which is the chapter of Yusuf. Although the other chapters in the Quran are centered around a theme. So let me just read some of the names of the chapters to give you an idea. You have a name like Al-Nisa, the women. Yunus, that's Nabi Yonah. Bani Israel, which should be self-explanatory. Al-Ankabut, the spider. Al-Qamar would be the moon. Al-Qalam, the pen, etc. And these names would center around an important idea in the chapter. But the chapter itself, if one were to read the chapter itself to the casual reader, it's somewhat incoherent in that the chapters do not go in story order, because there really is no story most of the time, and the chapters do not always go in chronological order. Now, how was this compiled? How was Quran compiled? We have the traditional view, which I will explain to you, and we have the rather atraditional view. The traditional view is that originally the Quran was not supposed to be put into a written form. And there were people who traveled with Muhammad who were professional memorizers, and they were called Hafiz, like the singer Abdul Halim Hafiz, and it was their job to memorize the words of the Prophet. And only at a certain point, when many of these professional memorizers were being killed off in battle, were the leaders of the Islamic community concerned as to what will happen to the text of the Quran. So the traditional view is that the third caliph, who was Uthman, the third caliph decided to put this oral version into a written form. He gathered as many memorizers as he could, and if you had, let's say, a group of 10, initially if 7 of them recited a verse in one particular way, with a particular spelling and a particular pronunciation, then that became the acceptable version to put into a written form. Later on, as more of the memorizers were killed off, they would go down to a smaller number. Instead of 7 out of 10, it became 4 out of 6. So in the Islamic community, in most of the Islamic world, at least in the Sunni Islamic world, as opposed to the Shia Islamic world, many of the texts will read in the introduction, it will be according to the Osmanic recension, being that the gathering of all the material was done during the third caliph, Osman, and put into its fixed written form, never to be changed, with no other versions in existence in the entire Islamic world. Now that's the traditional understanding of how the text was fixed by the third caliph, which would sort of negate that any written version existed before. However, this is not quite true. Because it is known that during the Khalifa of Abu Bakr, that Omar, who was going to become the second caliph, approached Abu Bakr and expressed his idea that even as early as the first successor to the Prophet Muhammad, even at that point, as early as 634, because Abu Bakr didn't last too long after the death of Muhammad, even as early as 634, there was a danger of the Quran to be forgotten. And that there were many, many scholars who believed that Hafsa, who was the daughter of Omar, one of the wives of Muhammad, who survived him, of course, that she had in her possession a recension of the Quran as early as perhaps 634 CE. The Shia maintain, the Shia being the largest minority group in Islam, the Shia maintain that in the earliest Qurans, all positive references to Ali were omitted from the Quran. Now why do they maintain this? Because the Shia believe that Ali was conspicuously absent from the leadership role after the death of Muhammad. The primary reason was that Ali was not possessing a white beard or white hair on his head, even though he may have been the most learned of all the potential successors, he wasn't the oldest. So he was skipped over in favor of Abu Bakr, in favor of Omar, in favor of Uthman. And finally, after Uthman was murdered, it became time for Ali to assume the leadership of the Islamic community. But if you look in the traditional understanding of tafsir, there are Sunni tafsirs and there are Shia tafsirs. The Shia tafsirs, like Al-Qummi is a very famous Shia tafsir. Their approach to Quran is very, very different than from the Sunni point of view, because they're traditionalists. Understand the text very differently, and in fact they divide the verses sometimes quite differently. I'll give you one example if my memory serves me correctly. In the second chapter of the Quran it says, ذَلِكَ الْكِتَابُ لَا رَيْبَ فِيهِ هُدَلِ الْمُتَقِينَ أَلَّذِينَ يُمِنُّونَ بِالْغَيْبِ. Let me just borrow the text for a moment, please. The second surah in the Osmanic recension reads, ذَلِكَ الْكِتَابُ, that is the book, already this is the book, لَا رَيْبَ فِيهِ هُدًى لِلْمُتَّقِينَ. This is the book, there's no doubt in it, a guide to those who fear God. But in the Shia version, the Shia, the way they recite the same verse, it will be ذَلِكَ الْكِتَابُ لَا رَيْبَ فِي هُدًى الْمُتَّقِينَ. They move over the ta'am, if I can use that term, to a different point in the verse. Their textual division in the recitation is somewhat different than the Sunni recitation at times. Now getting back to the structure of the Quran and the written form, yes.
You said the Sunni and the Muslim and say
Shia.
Shia, I'm sorry. What is the mean a totally different thing, the way they read it?
I say at times the way they divide the verse is different. It changes the meaning of the verse, yes. Yes, and as I mentioned a few minutes ago, in their tradition, in the Shia tradition, many of the Shia Hukama scholars, they maintain that there were many omissions of Ali that were in the original Quran, they were left out by the Sunni. Now, in 1972, I'll just mention this parenthetically, there was a Quran found in Yemen with many, many readings that are not in the traditional text.
Did they have the references to Ali?
No. Also, if you go through the entire Quran, if you look at an English Quran, you'll see that God is the one who speaks, except for the first chapter. The first chapter, we speak. We are the ones who praise God. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. We praise God. But chapter 2 to the end, it's God who is speaking. This leads some scholars to believe, Western scholars, that in the original Quran, when it was put into its written form, the Fatiha, the opening chapter, was not present. It was not in the original Quran. And in fact, I don't have the book with me. But I can assure you there have been at least two different versions, other than the one that we have in the traditional text, two different versions of the Fatiha that do exist in different Quranic recensions. Which means that if there are different recensions, popular recensions of the Fatiha in the hands of individuals who have handwritten manuscripts rather than printed manuscripts, it means that at one time there were popular versions, popular in quotes, different versions of the Quran that were in the hands of other individuals that may have been circulating until the fixed text was finally reached somewhere about the year 670, 680, in that period. So there was a prehistory. What I'm trying to emphasize, there is a prehistory to the fixed text of Quran. Now, even if we accept the traditional Muslim view that the text was fixed in the year 670, 680, it means there was a certain fluidity to the recensions from the death of Muhammad in 632 for some 50 years. Some Western scholars, however, believe that the text was fluent until the year 750 CE or even later. This is being it has been worked on since about 1975, but totally rejected by the Islamic world. Now, where do the Jewish people fit in to this picture? When do the Jews come in contact with the Arabian Peninsula? Well, we find that there is a Jewish contact with the Arabian Peninsula perhaps as early as Shlomo HaMelech. And we all know the earliest references to Jewish contact with the Arabian Peninsula would be the trip of Malkat Shiva to Israel to visit Shlomo HaMelech. And Shiva would be in the southern point of the Arabian Peninsula, where Yemen is today. We do know that the South Arabian language, which is different somewhat than the Northern Arabian language, which this happens to be the Northern Arabian language, Northwestern Arabian language. The Southern Arabian language was spoken and written as early as 500 BCE. So there are hundreds of monuments found in Yemen which testify to a kingdom in South Arabia at least as early as Ezra HaSofer, and if we accept the face value of the story in Sefer Melachim, then it goes back as early as 950 BCE. So there is a possibility that Jews were in existence. There was a Jewish colony in the Arabian Peninsula as early as 950 to 1000 BCE. The next occasion for Jews to enter the Arabian Peninsula would come after the year 586 BCE with the destruction of Beit HaMikdash HaRishon. Not only were the Jews exiled to Babel, but there was a Jewish colony, we know from Sefer Yirmiyahu, there was a Jewish colony found in Egypt, perhaps even earlier than the destruction of Beit HaRishon. And there is some epigraphic evidence that Jews were living in the Arabian Peninsula as early as 400 to 500 BCE. We don't know their numbers because unfortunately for us today who want to know as much as we can about our brethren who lived in the Arabian world, any kind of epigraphic evidence, any written evidence that existed has long vanished. In other words, any written manuscripts that existed concerning Jewish settlement in the Arabian Peninsula prior to the period of Muhammad, except for a Jewish poet or two, has long vanished. The Yemenite Jews, to my knowledge, in their many, many manuscripts do not preserve any memory of any earlier Jewish settlement in the Arabian Peninsula. In other words, their manuscript work is primarily of a religious nature and not of an historical nature. There are no chronicles which would delineate their history in that part of the world. Yes?
Was there, is it true that they would choose in Syria during the time of King David or around that time?
They're probably from the time of Shlomo, because the kingdom of Israel extended into Aram at that period. You know that there is ample evidence from names. The study of names is a very important study, and it's called, the term that's used for the study of names is onomastics. So you can take a name from the Torah, like Elkanah in Sefer Shemuel, and from that you get a very accurate picture of how God was believed in. Elkanah is God who possesses. Konei shamayim v'aretz. Or you have, you say that God is, Abdullah. Ovadia. Ovadia in Hebrew. What is Ovadia? The servant of Yah. So when you study names, you see that Jews were living, we know, in Moab. How do we know Jews were living in Moab? We have the Sefer Rut. It tells you as early as the Shoftim period, Jews were living in Moab. And there's no doubt in my mind that Jews were already living in Ammon, living in Edom. Because Jews were traders and they were migrating throughout the world at that time. The third period in which you find ample evidence for possible Jewish emigration into the Arabian Peninsula would come after the Minid Bar Kokhba. The Minid Bar Kokhba in 132 CE. After 3 years, 135 CE, the last attempt in the ancient world to establish an independent Jewish kingdom fails. The Jews are being slaughtered. They're being sold once again as slaves. We are pretty certain that Jews, in rather large numbers, migrated not only into the Negev Desert, Masada, but they also migrated into the Arabian Peninsula. Yes?
The citadel in Halab, it is believed to be built by the Abbot
Shulgar. There's no doubt in my mind that during that period, that Jews did live there.
And they did in there, even though the government hides it and he put it in areas of
Syria. Well, are you familiar in Syria some years ago? I believe about 1976 or 1977, there was an Italian archaeological team. There was Giovanni Tetinato, and he made this spectacular discovery in a place called Tel Marduk. And they uncovered a city which had literally disappeared from the face of the earth, called Ebla. And in the tablets they've uncovered from this city of Ebla is the first evidence of the cities of Sodom and Amora mentioned outside of Mikra. And in the archaeological finds, there are very, very few epigraphic finds that have been published. Most of the finds that have been published have been mostly ceramic. And one of the reasons for this is because the epigraphic finds that have come out from the list of names, it is evident that the names were West Semitic. West Semitic means ancient Hebrew type names. And of course, we don't have to look too far as to why the Syrian government wouldn't want this material printed, wouldn't want the tablets printed. It would give the Jewish people, you know, a firmer grip on that part of the world. And I might mention that the Vatican, which was sponsoring the dig, tremendous pressure was put on the Vatican not to allow the epigraphic remains to be published. And although the dig has been worked on amply since the mid and late 1970s and early 1980s, it's at least 20 years, very, very few tablets have been published in legitimate journals. Most of the material we do have has been, the material has been published privately, because the government of Syria is doing its best not to allow this out. Now, getting back to our story. So it's fairly certain to conclude that by the beginnings of the Islamic period, there's undoubtedly that Jews lived for certain in the city of Yathrib, which later became Medina. And although there's no direct evidence, it's fairly safe to say that Jews probably either lived in Mecca or else passed through Mecca. In addition, of course, although it's not a lecture on Christianity, there's ample evidence that Christians also had established a presence in the Saudi, in the Arabian Peninsula at the same time. Now, we're concerned with the influence that Jews had and Jews had during this period on the Quran. And I'm going to read some things for you. I made a list of rabbinic Hebrew words that are found in Quran. In other words, these are words that are borrowed directly from rabbinic Hebrew, Mishnah, Gemara, Tosefta, right into the Quranic idiom. Now, let's see if you know some of these words, the ones that may not be familiar to you. Tabut. What is tabut? Teva. Teva. Taurat. What is Taurat? Torah. Okay. Janata Adin. Janata Adin. Gan Eden. Jahannam. Okay. Darasa. We have Rabbani. Rabbani. Rabbi. Our rabbi. Sakinah. Shekhinah. Ta'ut is Ta'a. The Arabs call it Ta'ut. Furqan. Furqan. Okay. Mathani. Mishnah. Malakut. Malkut. Hayu wa Qayumu. Hay wa Qayam. Ribban al-Alimina. So here we have a list of some 15 terms that I drew up for the lecture purposes to give you an example of many, many words that are found in Quran which are not from Arabic sources, but from rabbinic Hebrew sources. And I'll go on to read the following to you. This is a question that was asked of me last week. The following Hebrew biblical characters make their appearance in the Quran. Who is Musa? Harun. Habil. Hebel. Ibrahim. Adam, you know. Habil. Cain. Daud. Jibril. Jalut. Goliath. Talut, Mr. Talut, the tall king, Shaul, Suleiman, Yunus, Yonah, Yusuf, you know, Lut, Nuh, Firaun, Tarpao. So here we have an example of many, many names found in the Quran, which are drawn from Hebrew sources. Yes?
Why would the Quran, which is starting, they're starting a new religion, saying everything else is wrong?
How do you know they're starting a new religion?
Well, whatever it is, why would they be using, referring to the Jewish things? Why
okay, all right, now...
Like Mishnah, like Rabbeinu,
The first thing you have to ask yourself, and remember, my role tonight isn't to provide answers. My role is to start problems. I gave a similar lecture last year in David Shlomo in Manhattan Beach. I dealt with different material, but the same topic, but different material. And the fact of the matter is, I like to bother you, get you to think about, well, how did Islam start? What was the purpose of what was Muhammad's role originally? Did he want to start a new religion? How did he view himself? You have to remember, all the sources we have are Arabic sources. All the sources we have, you have to question, when were they written? Are they contemporary with Muhammad? I'm just asking you this question rhetorically. Or were they written hundreds of years later? In the so-called sacred literature of Islam, at the Quran you have the collections of hadith. And the greatest codifier of the, or gatherer of the hadith was Al-Bukhari. Al-Bukhari, he went and spent most of his life gathering traditions about Muhammad. And he collected them by the hundreds, maybe by the thousands. And then he would discard which he didn't believe were true, and those he felt were reliable, he'd keep. Now, Al-Bukhari lived in the 9th century. Muhammad died in 632, and Bukhari lives some 250 years later. It's quite a bit of time. The biographer of Muhammad originally was Ibn Hisham, and he bases his biography of Muhammad on an earlier biography of Muhammad, Ibn Ishaq. And we have to assume, when did Ibn Ishaq live? About the year 750. Ibn Hisham lived about 100 some odd years later. And to what degree is the material of Ibn Ishaq considered to be reliable? How about Ibn Hisham? Are there any typographical errors? Not so much typographical. Are there any manuscript errors? Intentional manuscript errors? How do we know that the poetry written there, the diatribes between the Islamic and the Jewish Arab tribe living in the peninsula where they used to throw darts at each other through poetry, how do we know that these poems are in fact a faithful reproduction of what was said? We just don't know. There's a very famous story of the Jews of the tribe of Banu Qurayza. And the Banu Qurayza, they met a tragic fate where, if we look at the different versions, between 600 to 900 of the men were beheaded. In the Quran, this incident is only glanced upon. It's hardly even mentioned. In the biography of the Prophet, he mentions it in great length. However, it's interesting to note that in the Middle Ages, a scholar like Ibn Kathir doubted whether this number of 900 was in fact true. And there's a scholar who wrote an article, modern-day scholar, who wrote an article some 9-10 years ago, his last name happened to be Arafat, but it wasn't Yasser Arafat. He wrote an article in the Journal of the Royal Asiatic Society where he says that many of Ibn Hisham's sources came from Jews who lived in the Arabian Peninsula and are to be cast aside. Now, if an Arab, Arafat, makes this statement about a book which is almost considered to be canonized in the Islamic corpus of literature, that this story is a fallacious story and exaggerated, well, I just throw this idea at you. How many more stories in that collection might be fallacious and maybe doubt to be cast upon those stories as well? And I have to emphasize again, it's like looking at the American Revolution only through the eyes of one person, or two people, without an objective view, without the British, or the French view, or the Canadian view, as to what happened during the American Revolution. Or looking at the Civil War only through the Northern eyes, without looking at what the South had to say, or what a foreign government had to say about the Civil War. So we're looking at a period of time, a formative period, in which we have only the Islamic viewpoint. And unfortunately, the Jewish viewpoint is lost. But there is a Jewish viewpoint. And the Jewish viewpoint is very clear. I gave you some of the inferences. There are names. There are terms. And I throw this question at you. Who was Muhammad aiming at originally? Was he perhaps aiming at the Jews? Well, you know, during the first year in Medina, he was facing a great problem. The Jews gave him many, many difficulties. Because as far as the Jews were concerned, their canon was closed. There was no more prophecy. And along comes Muhammad and makes a claim that he is the Rasul Allah, the messenger of God. And his message isn't only another message, it is the message. And all other religions are to be cast aside. That the Islamic message is supposed to be the dominant message. And I can read the ayah for you. I think I have it here somewhere. I don't want to... I know it's in this particular surah. I know it's here. It's what you well, you just have to take my word for it. You know, it's looking for when you want to find it, it's difficult to find. But I know it's in this particular. It's in this surah. Okay. I'm sorry. I can't find it at this moment. Okay, you have to just take my word for it. So my point is that we have to examine Muhammad's message when he came to the Jews, and he turns to the Jews and says, well, we'll face Qibla al-Quds. When we pray, we'll face Jerusalem. And the Jews still reject it. And then he said, we will accept the fast day of Salam al-Ashura, the fast of the eighth day. And the Jews will still reject it. And we'll turn away from eating flesh of an animal that is found dead. And we'll turn away from eating, consuming blood. And we'll turn away from eating the flesh of the swine, of a pig. And the Jews will still reject him. And of course, if we take the Quran and the ancillary literature, we take it, the combined mass of material we find is that as the rule of Muhammad becomes more and more entrenched in Medina, the antipathy, the hatred, the tension between the Jews and the growing Muslim community is about to explode, and the Jews have to be removed. But in the Quran itself, there are certain ideas that touch upon us very, very strongly. One of them is the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and the other one is the Holy Land. Is there anything in the Quran that says anything about Eretz Yisrael being our land? Well, there is. I'm going to read something for you now. Okay. Ya qawmi, udkhulu al-ardh al-muqaddasa, alati kataba Allahu lakum, wa la tartadda ala adbarikum. Which means, all my people, go into the holy land, which Allah hath ordained to you. Turn not back in flight. So it tells you right here in the Quran that we were the ones who were supposed to go into the Holy Land. We were ordained to go into the Holy Land. And then if you look a little bit further, it tells you here, وَقُلْنَا مِنْ بَعَدِهِ وَقُلْنَا مِنْ بَعَدِهِ لِبَنِي إِسْرَائِيلِ اسكنوا الأرض وإذا جاء وعد الآخرة جئنا بكم لطيفا. And we said unto the children of Israel after him, dwell in the land, and when the promise of the hereafter comes to pass, we shall bring you as a crowd gathered out of the various nations. In other words, what it is saying here is almost a quotation from the Nabiim, that when Mashiach comes, we will be taken from all the nations and brought into the land of Israel. So you have here in the Quran, usually these verses are usually conveniently left out, they're omitted. We have absolute proof that the Quran states that we were brought into the land of Israel. That the land of Israel is ours, an ard al-muqaddasa. And Al-Ard al-Muqaddasa has no reference to Makkah, has no reference to Medina. He's speaking directly about Banu Israel. Then regarding the Al-Aqsa Mosque, now we all know what the Al-Aqsa Mosque is. So you know, of course, that according to the Islamic tradition, Muhammad went from Mecca, he went through God to the heavens, and he came down and landed at Al-Aqsa. What does Al-Aqsa mean? What does the term Al-Aqsa mean by itself? It means the farthest point. That's all it means. Al-Adna, the nearest point. Al-Aqsa, the furthest point. Nothing magical in the term, no reference to Jerusalem. The surah that I'm going to read to you in a few minutes, the surah which has this very, very famous ayah, was revealed in the year 621, approximately, based upon the historical inferences in this verse. In 621, who was controlling what is now the land of Israel? Which empire controlled that area? The Byzantine Empire, the Eastern Roman Empire, and the Sasanian, the Persian Empire, they were fighting over that piece of land. The Muslims were nowhere near that part of the world. The Arabs were nowhere near that part of the world. There was no mosque on the Temple Mount. Al-Aqsa was not built. The beginnings of the Al-Aqsa Mosque were not built until about the year, about 715 CE. what led to the preeminence of Al-Aqsa is interesting and is related to the Umayyad dynasty. You know, after the death of the fourth caliph was Ali ibn Abi Talib. So we had Yazid as the caliph, and Yazid wanted his son to take his place, was Muawiyah. And Muawiyah wanted very, very much to have the grandson of Muhammad, you know, who was Hussein, to give his approbation that he should be the caliph. Because after all, as the grandson of the Prophet, it's a great yahus to have him say that he should be a caliph. And when Hussein didn't want to do this, and certain forces in Iraq prevailed upon Hussein to make a move and challenge Muawiyah ambushed him in the plains of Karbala, and Hussein was killed, and about 70 people with him. And for the Shia, the death of Hussein on the plains of Karbala is considered to be the greatest redemptive act in the history of humankind. So in the Shia calendar, in the month of Muharram, to reenact the death of Hussein on the plains of Karbala, they have the equivalent of what used to be a very common occurrence in medieval Europe. They have the reenact of the passion play of the death of Hussein, where the Shia will go in a circle and they'll hit each other with chains and cut each other's head open to feel the pain and identify with the suffering of Hussein. And of course, Muawiyah, knowing that he had a hand in the death of the grandson of the Prophet, he wanted in some way to restore himself and the greatness of the Umayyad dynasty. And he set about with this incredible building campaign in Jerusalem. And he set about with this magnificent building campaign, building mosques and building palaces for the major purpose to drive a wedge between the Western Arabs and the Arabs living in the Arabian Peninsula, in particular in Makkah and Medina. And it is this alone which thrust the importance of Jerusalem on the face of the Arab world. Yes?
Who controlled Israel at that time when they built Islam?
At that time, they were always under Muslim control. In fact, you see, there is a very famous pact. It's called the Pact of Omar, in which the Jews and Christians are told what they can do, what they can't do. The Jews and Christians are to be expelled from the Arabian Peninsula according to the will of Muhammad, which is no proof he ever said that. And in addition, how Jews are supposed to dress and what they can do, what they can't do in the Islamic world. But that really isn't the directive of the Caliph Omar. It's about 100 years later, but it's thrown back in time as if it was the first Omar that said that. Getting back to our story, we're speaking about Al-Aqsa. So in 621, it tells you here, سُبْحَنَا لَذِي أَسْرَى بِعَبْدِهِ لَيْلًا مِنَ الْمَسْجِدِ الْحَرَمِ إِلَى الْمَسْجِدِ الْأَقْصَى. Praise be he who carried the servant by night from the inviolable place of worship to the far distant place of worship. Assuming that it was Muhammad that the verse is speaking about, and there's no proof it was even Muhammad. If we look at things objectively, there's no mention of any name. And when it is the Abdihi, it could be any Abdihi, anyone who was a servant of God. But even if it were Muhammad, to go from Mecca to where the Mosque of Al-Aqsa is today is highly unlikely. What it probably did mean that Muhammad, if it were he probably would go from the mosque in Mecca to the mosque in Medina, or somewhere out of Medina. Or if you look at the medieval commentaries, some of the medieval commentaries, classic commentaries on Quran, would state that it meant that Muhammad was going to the highest heavens to be closer to God. In a sense, like a mystical vision, something like found in the visions of the Haskir. Yes, go ahead, baby.
So you can understand from the roots of the writings where the invasion begins from the Muslim world to the Jews, but what's the Muslims' perspective against the Christian world? How is their relationship different between the Christians versus the Jews? And where did that move from?
Well, I can tell you very, very, very simply that the Christians, the view of the Trinity in the Quran is very different than the view of the Trinity as found in Catholic Church or in standard Protestant Church. Let's speak about evangelical churches. In the Quran, they deny that Jesus was crucified. And they maintain that he was never a son of God, that he was nothing more than a prophet. So they do call him, yes, but they do call him Messiah. But there's no idea of what Messiah means in a Jewish idea of Messiah. And it really isn't known. Unfortunately, there's not much work done on this in the scholarly world. And where these... Which Christian group did these ideas, in fact, emanate from? Because what we have today is a standard Christianity, and what some of you might know, that probably down through the as late as the 13th century, there were many, many different Gnostic Christian groups that existed in parts of the Middle East and existed throughout parts of Europe, the roots of which probably would originally go back to Zoroastrianism, the good and bad God fighting each other, and these ideas somehow traveled in a westerly direction. So, as I said a while ago, I don't know if you were here then, there's really, from a scholarly perspective, there's more we don't know about the origins of this book. Quite frankly, because the Western world has only begun to examine this book as literature in great depth, only really in the last 100 years. I might also add that if you go into let's say you went to Barnes and Noble, and you went to the religion of Barnes, you would see commentaries in English on Bereshit, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, written by many Christians. And there are learned Christians. When I was in Yeshiva University many, many years ago, I was going back to the early 1971, 72, 69 to 72, there was a scholar who taught a Bible there, William Foxwell Albright, and I'm sure many of you who are interested in archaeology, anyone interested in biblical archaeology, knows that in East Jerusalem there's the William Albright Archaeological School. He was one of the deans of archaeology. This man spoke fluent Hebrew, modern Hebrew, and he could quote as well as anyone, quote Mikra. But you will not find a commentary on Quran by any Jewish or Christian scholar. You'll find the Quran translated into English. You'll even find the Quran translated into Hebrew. One of my teachers was the first one to translate Quran into Hebrew, Yoel Rubin. But you won't find any commentaries on Quran by a Jewish or Christian scholar. It becomes something that's off limits. I don't know why. Because there are many Jews, many great Jewish Islamists, but their approach to the book maybe would be too hypercritical, not in a negative sense though, in a sense to find out the sources of this book, where in fact they come from, and what debt does Muhammad have, as I try to give you an indication, what debt does Muhammad have to Judaism and to Christianity? Because as far as the Muslim world is concerned, Islam is the only complete religion. So there's no debt to Judaism and no debt to Christianity. Yes?
In the Quran, does it actually say that to kill Jews and you are the enemy? Or will they get, does it really actually say about them?
Well, there are many uncomplimentary passages about Jews. Jews are referred to as being, at times, as being kuffar, as being hypocrites, as being liars, the same way as Muhammad's enemies who were not Jewish or Christian. His own Arabs who turned on him are looked upon as being mufsidin. There are many, many terms that Muhammad uses in the Quran to describe his enemies. But he's speaking about a contemporary audience. There's nothing. Now, I've read quite a few of the classic commentaries on Quran, on those sections of Quran that deal with Banu Israel. There's nothing in any of the classic commentaries on Quran which say that the Jews are not entitled to the land of Israel. There's nothing which says that Jews are a people that are damned forever. There are statements, however, in Hadith, which are quite damning to Jews in the sense that especially the day-to-day contact Muslims had with Jews during the formative period of Islam was one when the Jew had to be the inferior and the Muslim was the superior. So in the Islamic world, in Spain, for example, when the Muslims controlled most of the Spanish or the Iberian Peninsula, someone like Shmuel HaNagid was going to be very, very rare and unique. But he could serve in the court of the Islamic leadership, whereas his son was killed. So Shmuel HaNagid was very rare. A Jew or a Christian, depending upon the rule, it could only go so far. But that's at a later period. We're speaking about the formative period, the early contact between Muhammad and the Jews and Muhammad and the early Muslim rulers and the Jews. Now, getting back to our central theme, how did Muhammad view himself? Well, I believe that Muhammad viewed himself as being the fulfillment of prophecy, but originally I believe that he viewed himself as being the last in a chain of prophets that began with Adam, and his message was originally aimed at the Jews. But why did the Jews have to reject him? You know, there's a very fine line between complete rejection and support for your ideas for someone else, but not for me. But why couldn't the Jews offer either one? Would anyone venture? Why couldn't they offer either one?
They never offered that to anyone. Jews never, to my knowledge,
right,
supported anybody who was not a card-carrying member of...
Okay, all right. So, what you're alluding to is that by accepting Muhammad in the guise of a prophet, or by accepting Muhammad in the guise of a messenger for someone else, viable messenger for the Jahiliyyah Arab, is like saying that all that was given to us has become nullified, and the Mizvot B'nai Noach no longer had any validity for the non-Jewish world. So for the Jewish people, Islam would have to be set aside, because we would have to view Islam as a message not applicable to us ideologically or intellectually, because Islam viewed itself vis-a-vis the Jew as being the superior, negating your idea completely. And the only viable idea accepted by Jews, where a non-Jew could be seen as an equal to a Jew, not in number but in quality, would be someone who accepted the Shema Mitzvot B'nai Noach. If you accepted those Mitzvot, then he would be entitled to, in qualitatively speaking, the same respect from God as we would have. And you are considered also to be one of the Yirei Shamayim. Anyone have a question? Any questions so far? Yes.
Tupo. This prophecy that Muhammad claimed to be getting, and this message that he had to transmit, what was this message? Was, as you implied before, it wasn't start a new religion. What was it? And the second half of the question is, can we view him, or did he ever think of himself as a Shabtai Tzvi type of character?
No. The first answer is that Muhammad views himself as being the founder of the original monotheism, which was vouchsafed to Ibrahim. And Ibrahim was not a Jew. Ibrahim was not a Muslim. Ibrahim was not a Christian. Muhammad goes back to this original monotheism and is offering it again, because between Abraham and Muhammad, let's say it were 10 years, 20 years, 1,000 years, no matter what the years would be, the original message given to Ibrahim, Abraham, was forgotten. And what he is doing, he is restoring this original message to its pristine form. That any other revelation that was given through Musa, through Isa, Jesus, was spurious. They were not complete. And he's going back to the original message. What was your second question?
Did he view himself as a Mashiach?
No.
Or was he considered like that?
No. In Sunni Islam, Muhammad has never sinned. And he would almost attain, but not quite, the level of divinity. So you can't speak against him. You know, we would discuss perhaps in a Beit Midrash why Moshe Rabbeinu was not allowed to enter the promised land. Was his sin that serious? We would be allowed to discuss that. Or discuss Aaron and Egel HaZahav. Or discuss some of the deeds of some of our other, like David HaMelech with Uriah HaHiti. But in the case of Muhammad, there's nothing discussed, because as far as the Sunni Islamic world is concerned, at least, he's ma'sum. Ma'sum, he's never considered, and he's never sinned in his life. And in fact, when he was a youth, he was called Al-Amin. Al-Amin is the person who is totally reliable and faithful. Unfortunately, we have no information about his youth, except what is found in obvious collections of legends strewn through the early literature of Islam. Any other questions? Yes.
Were there any Jews associated with Muhammad as teachers?
There are references in Quran to teachers of Muhammad who taught him the incorrect doctrine, and it's usually thought that those teachers were Jews. I mean, contemporary scholarship would consider them to be Jews, that it's highly unlikely that he didn't have any contact with Jews. I mean, we know he had contact with Christians, because his first wife, Khadija, one of her cousins, was a Christian, and he is supposed to have prophesied his prophethood when he got his first revelation. But there is circumstantial evidence, let's put it that way, that he did have contact with Jewish teachers, but there's no hard evidence that he ever read Hebrew scriptures either in Hebrew or in Arabic. Now I'm emphasizing that because in the case of some of the Shia leaders, the early Shia, there are books where the Hebrew scriptures, there are quotations of Torah in Arabic letters, and pretty faithfully recorded. So there's some indication that in the Shia, at least, there was some contact and some fluency, at least, in Hebrew language, and some knowledge of Hebrew scripture, whereas among the Sunni, it's highly doubtful. There is a treatise that was written in the Middle Ages, a polemic treatise. I forget the name, because if you had asked me this question last week, I would have prepared. Probably written in the 14th century, which is a rather superficial treatment of Judaism and Christianity, but a very superficial treatment, evidently coming from a secondary or tertiary source. Even today, there is an encyclopedia which has come out in Cairo. It's on CD-ROM, and it's also in about 20 volumes, called the Encyclopedia of Judaism and Zionism. And it has the sanction of Al-Azhar University. When you read through it, even the introduction, you can see right away it's highly subjective. I'll use that term politely. Really, really not much value in it from an intellectual point of view, other than pointing to an approach to Judaism which is anti-intellectual and certainly biased, heavily biased against us. Any other questions? Yes.
Is it mentioned in the Quran about the Sheva Mitzvot or the
no.
or the Ten Commandments?
There are commandments mentioned. The story of the Egel HaZahav. There's an allusion to Ma'aseh v'Nishma, but they take it differently as we shall rebel.
Do they have any poor morality
in Quran?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you're asking me questions that are somewhat off the beaten path, but I can tell you that the Quran is a mixture of pre-Islamic ethos, the way of the life of the Bedouin warrior. It's a mixture of a superficial knowledge of Judaism. A very superficial knowledge of Roman and Greek law, a superficial knowledge of some ideas concerning Near Eastern mythology, a superficial knowledge of some legends concerning early Christianity, some legends concerning Alexander the Great, and all of this has become submerged under some inspiring description of God's creative powers. But the overwhelming power of this book is seen in its lashing out and punitive rhetoric directed over and over and over again against non-believers and people who are considered to be kuffar. Now, I might be a non-believer, but a kuffar is someone who denies completely. So I, as a Jew, I'm not a believer in Islam. But a kuffar is someone who denies. Might be a Muslim, like if you remember the Salman Rushdie affair, where he was a kuffar. So a kuffar is to be eliminated. So when we have this mixture, like a stew, and it's boiling and seething over a period of so many years in the mind of one individual, assuming this is the product of the mind of one individual, and what comes out is sometimes great genius, sometimes great bias, sometimes great hatred, and sometimes passages of extreme beauty. But the sum and substance of everything is a belief system which has little tolerance for differing points of view. Because if you believe that your system is the only complete system, and any other believer is partially right, and what we have said, we have removed Muhammad's name from Torah, The Christians have removed Muhammad's name from Injil. Injil is the New Testament. And everything we have is munharif, is distorted. And everything we have is something that's mansukh, and has to be thrown aside and rejected. And what you do is, from a Muslim point of view, you look at the other person and say, well, your belief system is worth very little, if anything. And you have no interest. Well, you might have an intellectual interest like you do right now in listening to what I have to say about Islam. The same way, if someone was speaking about the relationship of Christianity to Judaism, I might be sitting and I want to hear what that person has to say. Well, because you can see there's a bridge between religions. A bridge between religions, to create this bridge, allows for a mutual respect between people. Even if you disagree with the person. But you can see there's a commonality. That a good person is a good person no matter what. But if I'm not considered even a good person, because my belief system is wrong to start with, then we have a long way to go. Before we can reach a state of being and a state of mind where I can extend my hand and you say, Anu Safir Ho Idaka, I will shake your hand as an equal. We haven't gotten to that point. We traveled the length of 1,400 years. So I can see in Islam the roots of Judaism. But the Muslim can't see in Islam the roots of Judaism. That's the problem, in a nutshell. Yes?
Other than the biblical portions that are in the Quran, do they refer to the books?
Yes, they refer to...
For the writings the way the Christians do?
They refer to Tawrut. They refer to a book...
Do they study it?
Oh, no.
Independently of the Quran?
There are possibly Muslims who have read Kitab al-Muqaddas, called the Holy Book. There are possibly. If there are, I've met many Muslim intellectuals. I have never met, I've met one, an Iranian, who has read the Hebrew Bible in Persian. Otherwise, I've never met any Arab who has ever ventured into forbidden waters.
So it's only the Quran, it's only within the Quran. That's why we and the rest of the world who are not Muslim are non-believers. Is that the reason? Because we don't accept the Quran? Because what is it that we don't believe?
You don't accept Quran. You have to accept Quran. You have to accept Muhammad as the messenger, last messenger of God. So, you see, there's a joke, an Egyptian joke. I'll try to tell it to you in Arabic. Mala wahda kana joha nashi fi sharia. So, joha was walking in the street. Wa sahibu shuftu shaku. He was wearing a jacket. La ilaha illa Allah. There's no God but Allah. So sahbu bisalu joha le man mush maktub ala jaketa wa Muhammad Rasulullah wa jamu joha ana ishtarit al jaketa ablu ma'lud Muhammad. He was like, bought the jacket before Muhammad was born. So it's a joke, but what the joke is trying to say is you could believe in Allah before Muhammad was born. You don't have to have Muhammad to believe in one God. But, you know, there's a very, very great distance between Joha, the country bumpkin, and what's acceptable by the masses of people. And what I try to do tonight, for us, is to show us, demonstrate to yourselves, to you and to me, that there is that bridge is there into the Muslim world is willing to take. In other words, if we sit down and we want to find out what are the Jewish roots in Islam. It doesn't negate Islam. The same way looking for the Jewish roots in Christianity doesn't negate Christianity. Because you can't prove a religion to be false. Religion ultimately is based upon faith. You know that. So we're not trying to prove something true or false. We're trying to show that Muhammad had a firm basis. on which to stand on, and that was Judaism. And if he considered himself to be a prophet in the line of prophecy, and we rejected him, well, it doesn't make, ipso facto, it doesn't make it that we are enemies of the Arab people today. Because I'm sure that some of you have very fond memories, and your grandparents have very fond memories of living in the Arab world, and their relations were rather good. But nonetheless, you know, things have changed in the world since then. With the creation of the State of Israel, what you have injected into the formula, which did not exist before, is political independence for Jews in Dar al-Islam. And I'll just make one concluding statement. And that is, the thorn in the mind of the Arab is that this land that the Jews control is land that should be under Muslim control, they believe. And anything ever taken away from Islam must always, at the end, revert back to Islam. So unless that particular theological note, very difficult to overcome, is overcome. Well, you know, it was overcome in Turkey, because the Turks went from a theocracy, they went into socialism, and the mosque in Turkey is carefully guarded. And people aren't really that much revered today, but when they walk in the street with a beard, or women with a covered head in Turkey. I don't know what to say about the Arab world and Iran today. You know, everything is in the hand. They say, "Kullu shi bi idi Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala." Everything is in the hands of God. And what we have to do is just to appreciate that we have the right to study as we wish. That I have the right to open a Quran as a Jew and look at it, and I have the right to open any book I want and to look at it, and to find the roots of that particular idea system. I don't have to be initiated into a certain club. These are not esoteric books. They're exoteric. They're for anyone. And when that happens in the Islamic world, or to quote Daniel Pipes, who's a rather eminent scholar in the Middle East, when Beethoven is heard, you know, in the Middle East, freely with a Jewish soloist, when Yehoram Gaon sings in Cairo, they'll know there's true peace. Thank you very much for coming.